Support for NPR podcasts comes from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters.
This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. Prepare yourself for the breaks, check it out.
This week on The Business, why would a director walk away from a studio dream job? We talk with the ex-director of X-Men 3. Plus, Hollywood writers ask themselves, to strike or not to strike? And old-school movie research in a high-tech movie world. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Now with alcohol monitoring bracelets, it's The Business from NPR. A month after its debut, the numbers are in. The Apple iPhone is a dud. No, wait, it's a hit. If you're confused, so are we. Last week, AT&T announced it had activated less than 150,000 iPhones, far fewer than analysts had predicted. Apple's stock plunged 6% on that news. But Apple executives said they'd actually sold 270,000 iPhones in that period. The discrepancy comes from the fact that AT&T appears to have done a lousy job activating the phones. In fact, Apple expects to sell 1 million iPhones this quarter, and more, they'll likely sell 10 million iPhones by the end of next year. To put that in perspective, it took nearly 2 years for Apple to sell 1 million iPods. After hearing the news that profits shot up 73%, Apple's stock rebounded, and Steve Jobs released his vice-like death grip from the neck of AT&T's CEO. Elsewhere, the guys who keep track of what you're watching on TV and on the web have hacked into your Xbox. Last week, Nielsen unveiled the first results from their new Gameplay Metrics, a service that can track what games users are playing, on which devices, and when. All stats that could help game publishers sell ads within their games. According to the Wall Street Journal, as gaming becomes more and more popular, game publishers will, quote, offer certain elements within their virtual environments, such as billboards in stadiums and vending machines inside buildings, for sale to brands. We at The Business look forward to the first game title to use the new Nielsen technology, My Personal Space, Invaders. Finally, the Walt Disney Company last week became the first studio to heed congressional clamoring for an end to on-screen tobacco use. Disney will eliminate cigarette smoking from all its family movies and will discourage smoking scenes in Miramax productions. A villain can be bad without smoking, said Disney CEO Bob Iger. Heroes can be cool without smoking. The tobacco industry had no comment, especially since there hasn't been smoking in a Disney family film since Cruella de Vil, and she used a holder. The policy will put a crimp in planned Disney consumer products, however, including Minnie's Menthol 100s and Mickey's My First Humidor. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on the show, exiting a job at the helm of X-Men 3. But first, now is the summer of the Hollywood scribes' discontent. The big subject around Hollywood water coolers these days is, well, Lindsay Lohan, of course. The second hottest topic is the possibility of a writer's strike. The question is, are Hollywood scribes a whiny bunch of overpaid malcontents, or are they just trying to get their fair share of the moolah cobbler? Michael Sipley is a Hollywood correspondent for The New York Times. Michael Sipley, welcome to The Business.
Well, thank you very much.
So how has the business been changing that's affected the writers?
Well, it's the changes to come that are affecting the writers. You know, the truth is that the business itself right now statistically is not all that different than it was 5 or 7 years ago. But everybody's worried about where it's going to be in 3 and 5 years from now. And that all has to do, whether it's movies or TV, with new modes of delivery that really have not become an economic reality yet. But everybody is certain or scared to death that they will become an economic reality in the next, before the next contract cycle has run.
So the writers think they're still being paid on candles, but they're afraid someone's going to invent the light bulb.
You know, that's essentially it. I mean, the reality here is that the two sides in these talks have a vastly different philosophical position toward the future, and those differences in philosophy are what make this such a dangerous moment.
And now, speaking of candles, they've been burned before. They sort of took a powder on things with home video in the contract they made on that. But what are the writers asking for, by the way? And what are the producers saying in return?
In the simplest terms, the writers are saying the time is now to define how we'll be paid for various kinds of new media delivery of the shows and the movies that we write. And that means, you know, if it's going to the internet, if it's going out on YouTube, if it's on a promotional thing out there, if it's on a cell phone. And that parallels what they've had in the past. When something goes out on DVD, they get a payment. When something goes out on cable TV or foreign cable, they get a payment. What the producers are saying is, look, we can't have that model anymore. We need all of the revenue from all sources to recoup what we spend on a program, and we can't be paying you once to make it and then another time to sell it in each of these various markets. We want things essentially to be one gigantic, simple revenue pool.
So the writers are saying we want more residuals, and the producers are saying we want to get rid of residuals. That doesn't sound like a particularly good recipe for labor harmony.
That you're exactly right. And that's that is not just an economic difference, but it's a philosophical difference.
So what are the studios and networks doing to prepare for a strike?
You know, you hear it different ways. There's no doubt. When everybody is afraid to go out and say boldly that that they are completely stockpiling. No one wants to provoke a strike, but it is extremely clear that in the theatrical film business, there is not going to be a picture shooting beyond June 30th of next year. Now, June 30th is an interesting date because that technically has nothing to do with the writers. June 30th is when the actors' contract expires, and the actors, who come along some, you know, 6 or 8 months behind the writers, are a far bigger factor, particularly in feature film, because that's an enormous union, and you can't be shooting a film.
Yeah,
without
I was going to say, if you think it's hard to make a movie without a writer, try doing it without actors.
Yeah, you can pull a script off the shelf. You can't pull an actor off the shelf. You got to have them there. So every major studio in the business has set an internal deadline. I think they vary a little bit. I think some of the studios have said after the beginning of the year they will not start a picture. Some of them might start a picture as late as March of next year. But by the time you hit mid-June of next year, there will be no feature films shooting. That's because no one wants to be caught out there with the actors walking out. So there's a frenzy right now because films book so far ahead of everyone trying to lock up the big actors to get that one or two pictures that they have left in them before that deadline occurs. Television's a little different, operates on shorter time frames. What appears to be happening is that some of the shows are going out there, and where they might have bought 15 episodes, they're buying 30. I mean, they're basically taking heavy orders in order to have a lot of programming stocked up.
The Costco approach, too.
The Costco approach, and then probably looking to using a lot more reality TV over the next year in order to bank against the strike, because they can produce a lot of that without writers.
Can we actually imagine a scenario in which more reality TV winds up on the dial? Is there no saturation point?
No, I think you can bet that there's going to be more. I think that one of the things that one worries about in these labor stoppages or threats of them is that they'll actually permanently change what's out there on the dial, because these shifts in behavior, you know, there's a case to be made, and I don't know that anyone's ever really worked it out, you know, indisputably, that the birth of reality TV to begin with may have been triggered by the last writer's strike 20 years ago, you know, that ultimately one thing led to another, and that companies began looking toward ways to operate with less dependence on writers, you know, because of a labor action. I think those things do have long-term and permanent consequences.
So finally, the all-important question, will there be a strike? What do you think?
There will absolutely be a de facto strike, okay? There's no question that work will stop because they've already made the decision not to book things to film after the 30th. So there's going to be a lack of work a year from now. Everyone's going to be on vacation.
The big slowdown is coming no matter what.
The big slowdown is coming no matter what. I am extremely reluctant to predict that there will be a strike. It's been 20 years. Time after time, we've seen a lot of brinksmanship, a lot of strike talk, people come to the cusp. I think a betting person has to bet that resolutions are found somewhere around the 11th hour, 0.59.
All right, well, we got to leave it there. Michael Sipley is the Hollywood correspondent of the New York Times, or I should say one of many Hollywood correspondents. Michael, thanks for being on The Business.
Anytime. Thank you, Claude.
When he was only 19, Matthew Vaughn came to Los Angeles from London with a dream of making it big in show business.
I had a job working for a producer, just doing every menial task he could think of. And
what were some of the more menial ones?
Oh, sharpening pencils. I had to do 30 pencils every morning and lay them out in a row. They had to be all identical on the guy's desk. If I was lucky, I was allowed to man the phones.
Vaughn realized pretty quickly that there were an awful lot of people who were as talented and as underemployed as he was. So he moved back to the UK, figuring that if he could make films there, it would be a lot easier to sell himself to Hollywood at some point in the future. In London, he ended up producing Guy Ritchie's gangster flicks Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, among other films. And he finally directed a film of his own, the hit London gangster movie Layer Cake.
I'm not a gangster. I'm a businessman, giving people what they want.
Long live the king.
You're a smart boy, but you keep very bad company.
When I hate guns.
Although that one is really pretty.
With that film on his resume, Matthew Vaughn returned to Hollywood, nabbing what he thought was the plum job of directing a gigantic Hollywood studio movie, the third installment in Fox's X-Men franchise. But 3 months into the job, he quit. Why he left may say as much about studio movie making as it does about Matthew Vaughn, the director. Matthew Vaughn, welcome to The Business.
Oh, thank you.
Take us inside the seduction, if you will, or the attempted seduction of you to direct X-Men 3, this very big, you know, aircraft carrier of a movie franchise at 20th Century Fox.
I actually chased X-Men 3. That's what people don't seem to understand. Is I heard they were looking for a director, and I really liked the X-Men movies, and all my life I'd been doing these small, interesting, quirky British films which had found an international audience, but at the same time were still quirky little British movies, and I grew up on big Hollywood films, and it's been my dream to make big films. So I rang up Fox and met with them and said I wanted to do it, and they saw Layer Cake and hadn't been released yet, but they loved it, and we signed on to do it. But then that's when I sort of learned that there is the Hollywood sort of, let's call it the cookie-cutting factory style of just making films. And I realized on X-Men, I would have been not even the floor manager. I would have been, you know, I got to press all the buttons to turn the machines on, but I wasn't allowed to program or change them. And Tom Rothman, who's the chairman of Fox, he picked the right date for the film to be released, and as a business decision, he made the right one, and I respected it for it when he made it, but creatively, I realized as a director, I had to establish myself as being a good director, because, you know, a lot of people have thought Layer Cake could have been a fluke, and my second film, I would have been judged a lot more, and I felt if I did X-Men 3, I had to make it better than X-Men 1 or X-Men 2. And with the time that they were making it, that they were giving me to make the film, I realized I couldn't make the film that was in my head. And that's why I decided not to do it. It's quite interesting because, you know, I'm a trained producer and a businessman, so I'm a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde.
There's a certain insanity to making a Hollywood movie, in as much as there's, you know, often hundreds of millions of dollars behind the production and then another couple hundred million in marketing. And you've picked a date to sort of deliver this baby even before it's you're pregnant, in a certain sense.
I think it's one of the new curses of Hollywood, of that they pick dates. I know Born Identity, or the newborn, is it Born Supremacy?
The Born Ultimatum is, I think, the newest incarnation.
I know they were still filming last week. So you're like, it's coming out in what, 2.5-3 weeks time?
Yeah, 3 weeks
still
time.
Still shooting. So, yeah, it was... So I think it's a crazy way of doing it, especially, as you said, the money that's being spent on, and the irony is they'll just throw money when a problem comes, they'll throw money at it to solve it. And I'm also a big believer that problems, a lot of the times, some of the best decisions I've made making movies have been due to not having the money and coming up with and it makes you rack your brain more, and you sometimes come up with a much better creative solution due to lack of funds. If you have too much money, it becomes sort of too easy, and I think it causes too much fat and laziness.
You went fairly far down the road with Fox. Were there moments where you said, well, what about this problem? And the answer from Fox was, well, just spend money. What were the conversations?
Yeah, well, the biggest problem I couldn't understand was the post-production schedule was very, very tight. And they just said, we'll just throw money at it, which, yes, you could have 1,000 people suddenly working on your CGI, but I'm a big believer that CGI, technically, you can always get it right with the right amount of time, but you should treat CGI like you treat cinema, you know, every other aspect of filmmaking. And it takes, one of the things that's changed, like when you edit a movie now, when I started editing, you did it on film. And it took forever. You had to cut, the film and tape it back together and then put it back in the machine, have a look. And then, you know, the Avid came out, the Lightworks, and you could just change things immediately.
That's digital editing for people who don't know the machines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So digital editing happened. And the difference is that you have less time for thinking and perusing and just, you know, and I think it's very important creatively. It's things shouldn't always just be happened on, you know, instantly or rushed. And that's what I was worried about was, it would be like, make a decision, stick to it. Make a decision, stick to it. Is that good enough? Not really. Well, it has to be good enough. Bang. Move on. And then you get mediocre products because of it.
What did your agent say to you when you wanted to bail out of that? And what did Tom Rothman say to you? Was there horror? Or what was the reaction?
My agents thought I was insane, but my agents always think I'm insane. Rothman was very decent about it. We talked about it. It wasn't like a snap decision. It wasn't me saying, okay, that's it, I'm out, guys. It was a very, I did a lot of work on the film. I wasn't paid and I storyboarded and worked on the script but I was always saying, guys, I'm not sure whether I can pull this off. And a lot of people were interpreting that meaning when I said I'm not sure I could put it off, like I was worried about my skills or confidence, and I was going, no, guys, I know I can do it, but I have a way of working, and I'm actually pretty quick, but I really take it very, very seriously what I do. So when I finally realized I couldn't do it, they were decent, you know. I didn't really have a single argument with them from the day I signed on to the day I left. And you know, they're big boys, and they knew how to get the product that they wanted and needed. And that's why I respected them. I saw what they were having to do, and the producer in me understood what they had to do. And I think that was also sometimes a little bit confusing for them, because I could talk to them as a producer, saying, I get it, you want to do this, you need to cut that scene, we need to get rid of this in the budget, flip it here. And they're looking at me like, Jesus, you're not you're the director, you're not meant to be getting involved in scheduling and all that stuff. But I can. So...
Is there a feeling that you understand it, so then go do it, boy?
Exactly. Like, you guys can do it, you'll get it, and you need a director that's just going to turn up and get, you know, and shoot the hell out of it and basically not do as they're told, in a way.
Matthew Vaughn is the director of movies like Layer Cake and the forthcoming Stardust. We reached him in London at his home. Matthew, thanks for being on The Business.
Well, thank you for having me, and we should do it again sometime.
Coming up next, grading movies with CinemaScore. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The studios spend millions on research from companies like NRG, MarketCast, and OTX to tailor marketing campaigns and distribution strategies. The research companies, in turn, employ armies of MBAs to provide the information the studios are looking for. And then there is Ed Mintz and his company, CinemaScore. You may have been to the opening night of a big studio film where someone handed you a small yellow card and asked you to bend back tabs, indicating who you are and what you thought of the film. In total, CinemaScore polls just 500 people on the first night of each major release. Later that night, pollsters compile the data and send it to Las Vegas, where Ed crunches the numbers. For the past 30 years, he's been compiling a simple database that seems as revealing about box office as any factorial, regressive, random coefficient, double-blind study. The business producer Matt Holzman spoke with the man behind CinemaScore.
Ed Mintz, welcome to the business.
Thank you for having me here.
So tell me what it is exactly that you guys do.
In general, we go out every Friday night and we poll the American moviegoer public on major studio releases. And in essence, we want their opinions, we want to know who they are, and we put it all together in reports and we sell this data to the studios.
What kind of information is it that you can provide?
Basically, we tell them the audience breakdown, what percent were male, female, all the different age breakdowns. We ask why you were drawn to this movie. You know, was it the stars or the subject matter? We also ask, would you buy this movie on DVD later on? Would you rent it? But mainly at the end of the line, we want a grade for them, A, B, C, D, and F. So in essence, what we get from that is we know the demographics of who attended this movie, and then we know what the word of mouth is going to be on this movie by studying the grades.
Now, you're not hired by the studios to go out and do that. You do that, and then they buy the data from you.
Right. That's an important difference. Every other research company basically does proprietary studies for the studios. In essence, if Warner Brothers wanted something done on one of their movies, they would go to one of my competitors, usually NRG or one of the major research companies. They would contract with them to have them do the research, and that would be it. I, a long time ago, thought I'd rather go a different niche on this thing. So what we did, we invested our own money. We started pulling all the movies, even if no one wanted to buy anything way back when we started, built a database. And eventually, as people got interested, we sold subscriptions, in essence, that they could buy all of the data. So what we offered was that Warner Brothers, if they needed to know something about a Paramount film, they could legally get the information because it was not proprietary research.
And how might the studios use that info?
You know, a lot of them look at this data and want to have this armed with the numbers because the director or a lot of important talent that's connected to the movie jumps on them and says, why aren't you promoting the movie more? Why aren't you putting more money into it? And they use these reports in many cases to say, look, it's soft. It's not drawing the right people. Whatever the different arguments are, a lot of the executives arm themselves with this data to protect themselves. But the major reason, I would believe, is should we spend more money moving it along from the second weekend on? You only have a couple of weekends, and then that's it. Once you get to the third or fourth weekend, the die is cast. You're not going to do anything more with it. It's either the word of mouth is running beautiful and you'll move on, or you'll sink.
So now, on predicting box offices, certainly data from that first weekend is going to be much less useful than the data from the first weekend and the second weekend combined. Now, you just provide the data after the opening weekend?
You're looking at what the drop would be. You're thinking that it opens up to $30 million, and then what will it do on the second weekend and determine how big of a drop it takes and then go from there?
Right.
That was the old way of doing it. If you remember when Godfather opened and some of these big monstrous movies where there were lines around the block, a lot of times the people that came out to see the movie couldn't see it that weekend. It was always sold out because there wasn't multiplex theaters, that many of them at the time. But now Spider-Man, Pirates, they all open to these massive numbers because there are enough screens that really can handle that tremendous opening. Now that figure could really be compared to the second weekend.
You can take the numbers for a movie that's opening this weekend, compare it to similar like movies of the past, and have a pretty good feeling of how this new movie is going to do.
Absolutely, and I know how the drops. I mean, I'll give you an example. You can, on a horror film, in general, with your eyes shut, you can usually just multiply the opening box office by 2.7. and you're going to be reasonable. It opens to $10 million. You figure it'll do about $27 million, give or take a few million. The second movie that comes out, if it's really the same junkie grades, maybe 2.1, 2.2 on the same horror film. These are things you learn.
But you wouldn't compare a B-movie horror film, small budget, bad special effects, and no stars with a studio picture with a big star and a big marketing budget, would you?
You're absolutely right. I would not do that. Age and gender and MPAA and genre are the backbone, not budget for me. I don't really look at the budget to determine how well it'll play.
All right, which is good because nor does the audience.
That's correct. I only care about what the audience will care about.
Do you find that since you're talking about an opening weekend, this is a somewhat self-selecting group? These are people who are obviously most primarily interested in this movie, people who are like, I'm not waiting 2 days to go see this film.
Right.
Does that have an effect on their rating? Do they have a more of a propensity to like the movie because they're so interested in Tom Cruise or whoever is in it, or more of a propensity to be very critical because their expectations are so high?
The reason I pick that group of people is that group of people cares, and they will reflect to others. What I always say to other people, when you look at my grades, here's what you do. If the film really attracts your interest, trust the grade, because who gave you that grade were also people who couldn't wait to see it and ran to the theater on opening night. So they sort of reflect you. But if you're not a Woody Allen fan and this Woody Allen movie gets an A+, forget it. Meaningless. Don't even look at the grade. It's silly. Now, ours is an ABC system. A is good, B is average, C is bad. D and F shouldn't have been made. Really, and I'm not being sarcastic. D's and F's, what the heck went on here? What are you doing? You had to know this was, nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but once you get it and you start testing it, you know. Generally, an F was just unheard of. The same thing with an A+. Over the 30 years, maybe I've got 40 or 50 movies that were considered that great, and I pulled thousands of movies, and that's all we had. So your extremes are rare.
Ed Mintz is the president and founder of the Las Vegas-based movie research company CinemaScore. Ed, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
Ever wonder whence great ideas emerge? Here's Ed Mintz talking about how he came up with the CinemaScore survey card.
Well, I'm sitting in Temple on the High Holiday, and I'm thinking, before the services start, I thought, how the heck? And all of a sudden, into my hand is placed a pledge card. And I'm staring at the pledge card, and I thought, thank you, God. Right here in Temple, I feel it.
The card looks just like a pledge card. It really does.
I took the bent tab concept, converted it to about, well, we have gender, age, grade. Would you buy it? Would you rent it? And why were you drawn to the movie? We have limited answers on each of these six questions, and all you do is bend back the tabs.
Right. Just for our non-Jewish listeners, unlike in church where you can actually put money in a basket on the high holidays, you're not really supposed to be handling money. So they give you a card, and there's no pencil because you can't write. That's work. That's forbidden on the holidays.
Exactly.
So you merely just bend back this individual tabs, and that is really a great story.
Isn't that amazing? And I sat there thinking, I can't believe that I'm sitting here in Temple and thinking, and I'm staring, and I know it's a winner.
You can see the divinely inspired card at kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with DVD audio, satellite radio, and MP3 capability. Learn more at acura.com.